Welcome back. And of course, this is when we always like to invite you guys to check out the website, The Valley Outdoors. And where else, Ava?
Facebook as well.
Yes, like us, please. Lots of cool stuff there if you're ever looking going anywhere in the United States. Would be any of the 50, you're going to be able to find the DNR website or whatever they want to call their game, fish, and park, whatever they want to name their particular institution that would be able to tell you what's going on in their state, whether it's hunting, fishing, or cool activities. So there you have it. So let me finish my story, Ava.
Yeah. Yes. So he's bleeding all over the place.
He's going through a psychological battle. He said, "You can't die out here," he said. "I was yelling at myself not to pass out again. Being a weirdo, here I am lying behind a dead elk and there were flies and hornets everywhere." His body went into shock. He started shivering. He stayed alert. 3 hours after calling the SOS, a chopper from Two Bear Air Rescue arrived. Two Bear Air Rescue provides no-cost search and rescue support in Montana, Idaho, Eastern Washington, and Eastern Oregon. One of the Two Bear staffers put a compression bandage on and a light tourniquet on the wound and helped hoist him into the helicopter. The chopper pulled him from the backcountry, dropped him off with emergency services in a nearby town. He was then transferred to Kootenai Health for treatment. In the meantime, his wife had rallied several buddies who arrived at the scene of the accident. They collected gear, finished dressing the elk, and packed out all the meat, which meant a lot to Ardell. "This is my first archery bull. Kind of a big deal, and I finally freaking killed one," he said.
Yeah, no kidding.
"Then I was lying beside it for hours thinking I was going to lose the whole thing. I was super fortunate. I had some friends able to drop what they were doing and help out, and my wife was a freaking stud and organized it." Lessons from the harrowing experience, which is always important, right?
Yeah, so what can we learn from this?
"While it was harrowing, it turned out okay considering the circumstances." He said he would have done several things differently. "Number one, I was rushed. I felt the pressure of trying to get the animal cooled off so I didn't lose the meat. There was no reason for me to rush and push it, and I wasn't paying enough attention." Additionally, he said he plans to make improvements to his medical kit and purchase a new tourniquet that he can better operate with one hand, and the one he had with him required keeping pressure on it to maintain tension, which made for a dangerous situation when he fainted. If the knife would have hit 4 to 6 inches one way or the other, it might not have been a good conversation. He doesn't know if he would have been able to get the bleeding under control if he had hit the artery. It makes you consider if it's worth hunting alone."
Yeah, I was going to say.
"And that's typically what I do. Typically, that's what he does. If it would have been way different and easier if I had someone else who could help me." So, yikes. Is that not a story or what, Ava?
Yeah, I don't know. I always go hunting with people. Like, and I don't know. It makes me nervous when people go out in the woods by themselves. Even if you're just hiking or whatever the case may be. I don't know.
Well, you remember this story about the two people on Isle Royal? They were hiking on Isle Royal, two of them, and both of them were dead.
Great.
That was earlier this year. And it's kind of like this weird thing because Isle Royal has had an odd number of deaths up there, but granted, I mean, you don't know. Things can happen. It's like the two kids out in Montana that were hunting. You heard about that story. I didn't talk about it on here, but did you hear about it?
I don't think so.
Well, they were out hunting, and apparently there was a storm that came in, and lightning hit the tree that they were near and killed both of them.
Oh, well, that is...
That's just...
That's crazy.
Sad, sad. Just, oof, not a good thing. Not a good thing at all. So, well, let's jump into some good stuff.
Please, because that was gory, and thank goodness he's all right.
Hey,
okay?
it was, oh my goodness, we're building the tense aspect. It's just like mysteries on TV. Then they send you into a break without telling you what happens.
Ugh.
All right, so good stuff. Out of Michigan, they have had a venison donation program that served a record number of meals this year. It's called Hunters Feeding Michigan, a Michigan Department of Natural Resource program. connecting donors, wildlife processors, and charities to help feed those in need. They processed about 140,000 pounds of donated venison during the fiscal year 2025, which ended September 30th. That equals more than 560 thousand servings of venison and sets a new annual record for the program, which allows hunters to share harvest by donating deer participating processors and helps distribute venison donations across Michigan. Every year, it seems like more hunters choose to donate their harvest to the program, which helps feed even more of our neighbors across the state, said Hunters Feeding Michigan program specialist Joe Pressgrove. I frequently receive calls and letters from the local food pantries thanking the program for the providing much-needed protein to their communities. The success of what Pressgrove calls such an amazing program is largely due to the hunters who choose to donate their harvest. The individuals who donate money towards processing expenses, the hardworking and dedicated processors, and of course the Food Bank Council of Michigan and Feeding America Food Distribution Network. Since 2007, they provided more than 3 million servings of venison to those in need. Hunters can add a monetary donation to Hunters Feeding Michigan when purchasing licenses or permits. The DNR urges outdoor recreationalists when purchasing licenses, consider adding a monetary donation to Hunters Feeding Michigan. And this is the cool part. Your contribution covers processing costs, turning donated deer into meals. A donation of $3 provides a venison meal for over 4 people in Michigan. So whether you're in Michigan or not, it's a fantastic cause.
Yeah, it's
and
super cool.
I'm really impressed with how they worked that, and they actually utilize the dollars very efficiently, which is not something we see, and hopefully we'll see more of those kinds of things when we look at trying to be more efficient with everything we do with it.
Yeah, it's always those processing fees, you know.
But well,
everybody's got to make money, you know.
Yep. And I think it's nice to see that going forward, people are working on providing services as well as that. So
right.
Pretty cool. Now we're up. Now we're going to go a little bit down.
Are we going
to
go down?
Yep. We got to go down. It's the way this goes. National park access is limited in Minnesota during federal government shutdown. Here's what to know, and this is going to be across any of the Midwest areas that we're talking about and that we broadcast in. In this particular scenario, Minnesota happens to be home of 5 National Park Service managed properties. The Voyageur National Park, Mississippi National River and Recreation Area, that's just down in Bloomington, Grand Portage National Monument, Pipestone National Monument, and the St. Croix National Scenic Riverway. Each destination is offering limited access to visitors during the shutdown, but there is no park-specific information on which services are available, as 68% of the workforce has been furloughed. The general rule that the Congressional Research Service cited is if the facility would be closed during non-business hours, it would be closed for the duration of the partial government closure. And while there's no site-specific information, the information available is rather ambiguous for a national park such as Voyageurs, where visitors do not need to pass through a visitor center or gated checkpoint, access may remain unchanged. So if you go someplace that you've got to go through a entry or see somebody, a park ranger, then odds are that park will be closed. So just be aware of that. Call ahead or find out from, where would you find out? TheValleyOutdoors.com.
Look at that.
Pull that up and see if your specific area that you're going to will be open. There have been many requests from Voyageur National Park staff in this particular case. They have not gotten back to anyone, and there's also no automated response. According to federal contingency plan, park roads, lookout trails, and open-air memorials generally will be open to visitors. However, those sites will have reduced visitor services, and the plan encourages people not to visit those sites where there's nothing going to be as far as services go. While decreasing the current task force of 68%, it's lower than the 87% staffing decrease during the 2018-19 government shutdown. where thousands of national park employees were laid off, took retirement packages earlier this year. 14,500 employees worked at National Park Service sites across the country. Now, only about 5,200 are still working and deemed essential. So, refuges, that's one of the things that comes up, obviously, with hunting. Much of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's work, they're also on hiatus during the shutdown. It operates with about 34% of the staff. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife operates 600 national wildlife refuges, including 21 in Minnesota, 71 fish hatcheries, and more than 100 offices. Each hatchery will have one employee available to oversee the work, as employees who oversee fish are deemed essential. During the shutdown, wildlife refuge units that were accessible with the help of an employee will be closed unless the Assistant Secretary for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks deems opening won't incur any additional costs. So check it out. Make sure you understand what's going on at your particular destination. And you can get at least a start on that going through the Valley Outdoors and the active, what do you want to call it, the interactive map that we have that's there. Well, let's jump to a good one. We finished up last week. I didn't quite get to finish the story because it was ran out of time, but I wanted to make sure I got it in regarding the duck stamp, federal duck stamp art contest. And James Houtman, we mentioned that he won it again. We didn't get the chance to list the details, and it's kind of funny when you think about it. He made it the federal migratory bird hunting and conservation stamp. It is a bufflehead, and there are three of them, and it's an absolute beautiful, beautiful painting. You got to take a look at it, and it was pretty neat as far as the look. It's the seventh time winning the federal duck stamp art contest, and he breaks a tie on this one with his brother, Joe, for the most victories in the prestigious wildlife art contest. It dates back to 1934. The brothers don't date back that far, right. But this
contest
they've
been doing it for a long time, though.
A third brother. Now, they're the third brother. He also won the duck stamp contest three times, giving the trio a combined win of duck stamps for 16 wins.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. It's just amazing. What to me is the most important thing about this whole deal is the federal duck stamp raises, crazy, approximately 40 million in sales every year.
That's awesome.
The funds support conservation of wetland habitats in the National Wildlife Refuge System for the benefit of wildlife and the enjoyment of people. It will be a lasting reminder of the rich waterfowl heritage. Encourage everyone, including those who don't hunt, to buy a duck stamp, which raises millions of dollars to conserve wildlife and healthy wetland habitat. Another Minnesota artist, Tom E. Miller of Kilkenny, placed second. He did a cinnamon teal, and Jeffrey Mobley of Tulsa, Oklahoma, finished third with an acrylic of a buffalo head. Some other key takeaways. Since it was established the duck stamp.
Yeah, let's talk about the duck stamp because I learned quite a bit about it recently.
Yeah.
And it's interesting.
This number is crazy. $1.3 billion has been raised to conserve over 6 million acres of wildlife habitat for birds and other wildlife opportunities and recreation on public lands. That's $1.3 billion. That's a B,
mm-hmm.
Not an M. When you look at all these things, and 290 entries were judged, 83 made it to the final round. Eligible species for this year were wood duck, gadwall, cinnamon teal, bufflehead, and ruddy duck. And you can see it online when you go check that out. And that can be pretty cool to see all the artists and what they do. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, so the duck stamp contest, anybody can enter it.
Mm-hmm.
It just has to be a hand-drawn or painted image, and you have to mat it a certain way. You have to hand it in by a certain time. But the cool thing is it's all anonymous, so the judges have no idea who they're judging. It's strictly based off of appeal and all the different things,
yep.
Right? The judges are different every year. So it's not even the same judges. So for this Houtman brother to win again, it like there is no favoritism in this either. Now, there is a certain style that the duck stamp seems to be going for, which is the Hauptmann style, because all three brothers kind of have a style.
But with different judges, I got to say, that's awful tough to be. It's just like, look, this is an actual depiction. But to do that and represent such depth that they have in the actual picture, because, I mean, if you look at the paintings, the depth of field they have and the perspective vision is just something beyond.
So my sister, she drew a duck entry one year. This was like back when she was in middle school. She got an honorable mention out of that, like hundreds of people hand in drawings or paintings. And my mom still has it framed because, it was really good. I'll have to send you a picture of my sister's entry because it was pretty good.
Yeah. Well, one of the judges was Tom Landwehr. He's from the former DNR guy from Minnesota, which is kind of cool. But I think it's
okay. So we have like a minute and a half. Can I just talk one more thing about the duck stamp thing before we?
Sure.
Well, I love it. I love it. Okay. I do. I think the duck stamp's great. Okay. Have you seen the movie Fargo?
Yeah.
The original from.
Yeah.
Okay. So the cop's husband is entering the duck stamp competition. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
So,
yeah.
Yes. When he drops off Arby's at her job, he sits there and he's eating and he goes, the Hauptmanns are entering again this year. So the Hauptmanns even get a name mention in Fargo. They've been around that long.
I know.
And have won that many times that even the original Fargo movie has to mention them. I love it so much.
It is pretty amazing. the one thing I'm going to tease you guys for next week.
Yeah.
We didn't get to the Campbell soup story.
That's
but
a big one.
You are going to want to stick around for the Campbell soup story. And also we're going to finally get to coping with lure addiction. And I think many of us in the listening audience have a lure addiction, whatever that is, as far as what species you're going to love that story. Well, tell you what, for Ava, myself, and Don Cleaver, we are out of here. I hope you guys have a fantastic and safe weekend for the Valley Outdoors. I'm Eric Olson. Have a good one.
Thanks for listening to the Valley Outdoors Radio, brought to you by Vexus Boats, building dreams with an unequaled passion for excellence. Catch us next week, same time, same place. Have a great day on the water or in the field.